This is KCBX, Central Coast Public Radio, here on NPR One.
Battery Randolph is a former coastal artillery fortification located at Fort DeRussy in the heart of Waikiki. Constructed back in 1911, the battery was built as a first line of defense against naval attack. Today, the fort has been repurposed as the Army Museum of Hawaii, and it's open to the public with free admission. Over at Schofield Barracks, an active military base north of Pearl Harbor, Tropic Lightning Museum showcases the 25th Infantry's history, along with Schofield Barracks' history. There is also an engaging display detailing the December 7th attack on Pearl Harbor, which included crippling aerial attacks by the Japanese on Schofield Barracks and nearby Wheeler Army Airfield. I'm correspondent Tom Wilmer. Come along and join Ian Fraser and Kathleen Ramsden as they take us on an audio tour of the Army Museum of Hawaii and Tropic Lightning Museum over at Schofield Barracks.
Right now we're at the Army Museum at Fort DeRussy, an under-the-radar, amazing little museum that people might not know about.
We're pretty proud of our museum here, located in Waikiki, right on the beach. Very easily accessible to any travelers who come to Oahu.
This was an active Army installation going way back in time, right?
Oh yes, way back in time. We're in a historic building, actually, from that time as well. They used it as a coastal defense artillery, which we'll talk about more later.
When does it date from? When did they first start an Army facility?
This battery that we're in was actually built in 1911 and used as coastal defense.
How long did it stay as an active military installation?
That's probably a good question for our museum specialist and historian.
And that is?
Ian Fraser.
Ian, tell us a little bit about that dimension.
Battery Randolph was started construction in 1908 and was completed in 1913. It was used clear up to the end of World War II, even though it was very obsolete by then. With the conclusion of the war, the gun was very obsolete. The Army tried to decide what they wanted to do with Fort DeRussy and Battery Randolph. Over the next 20 years, it was used as many things. The battery was actually used as bathhouses, showers for the servicemen that used the beaches. It had an alcohol store. And at one time, it was even a bomb shelter. Eventually, the Army decided they wanted to do something with it. They had absolutely no intention of giving up Fort DeRussy. So there was no need for Battery Randolph. The Army tried to demolish it. The contractor came in and used wrecking balls. They couldn't use explosives because the explosives would damage the surrounding buildings. Remember, this is downtown Honolulu, 1970. So there are high-rises everywhere. The contractor tried for months to demolish the battery, went through several wrecking balls, and they finally gave up. So we had this eyesore sitting on the beach, downtown Waikiki. So the Army decided to turn it into a museum. So on December 7th, 1976, Battery Randolph became the U.S. Army Museum of Hawaii.
Tell us your story and your expertise and what you deal with. You're a curator.
Yes, my collection's up at the Tropic Lightning Museum, Schofield Barrack, which is another Army post.
And what's the derivation of the name?
The Tropic Lightning Museum is actually named after the 25th Infantry Division, and their nickname is Tropic Lightning. And they got that in World War II. So we're named after the division whose main story we try and cover, as well as the history of Schofield Barracks and Wheeler Army Airfield, which also has a very interesting history.
It really does. Intrinsic and primary to your mission has to do with Tropic Lightning on one dimension.
Yes, on one dimension. And then also the post itself, the land that they occupy, and its history as well. And then also the history of the Army Air Corps and how that turned into what we have as the Air Force. And so Wheeler Army Airfield is utilized now with the Army. But before, when it was part of the Army Air Corps, we had control over it and then went over to the Air Force. And that's a real interesting history because during that time it was pivotal in a lot of these aviation-type races in the 1930s. So,
oh, wow.
Yeah, so you see Amelia Earhart up at Wheeler. You see Sir Kingford Smith, lots of different aviation races. People would gather for miles just to come see the participants land. And it was a huge spectator sport during that time.
And if anybody has not seen Schofield Barracks, probably one way to put it in your mind would be the classic From Here to Eternity, which they filmed there, right?
Yes, yes, absolutely, it would be.
And then the new version of Pearl Harbor as well, correct?
Yes, it was also featured in there as well. There's actually quite a few movies that are associated around the division and the area. So we're pretty well known, even though people may not know the numerical designation of the division as the 25th Infantry Division. But because they're the protectors of the Pacific, you see them engage in a lot of the different combat things that we had going on over the century or decades.
Continue with Wheeler and Schofield both. December 7, 1941, everybody thinks of the Japanese Zeros coming over Pearl Harbor and dropping bombs on Pearl Harbor, but it kind of gets missed, that story of Wheeler, Hickam,
yes,
that whole story. Tell us about Schofield Barracks and Wheeler and the role they play.
Well, actually, Wheeler is considered a National Historic Landmark because of its time associated with December 7th. It was one of the major places that got bombed because of its strategic location and also its use as an airfield. They actually came around and attacked it the first time and then did a second time trying to get it completely unusable. They were afraid that the Army would be able to strike back if they didn't render us inoperable, basically.
As I remember, maybe I'm wrong, but it's at least two or three of our fighter aircraft got airborne from Wheeler and got into dogfights and took down some Japanese aircraft.
Yes, that is true. The first-person account stories that we have from that are real interesting of the gentlemen who were even featured in the movie we were talking about earlier, the Pearl Harbor movie. They talk about their exploits in that, which is, I can't imagine going through that today. If you look up in the sky today and saw an attack, what would we do? You know, it takes a brave kind of soul to be able to think that clearly and quickly at that time.
Yeah, no kidding. A lot of people thought it was training exercise.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Although on a Sunday, they didn't normally have them. So that did raise a few eyebrows. And when you looked up, you could see the big red rising suns. That alerted some people to the severity of what was happening. But they certainly didn't think that they were going to have an attack.
So you have World War II veterans who have been returning, and have you been doing oral histories and interviews and hearing their stories?
Oh, yes. It's amazing the stories that they have. And I think the older they get, the more they realize how important those stories really are to us, to the younger generations, and how we want to preserve them and make them so that they're available for people to read and understand what they... We do want to keep the first-person accounts of our World War II veterans because they are critical to the future. And I think they realize now that talking about their time during World War II, while maybe very difficult, is something that's beneficial for generations to understand and read and capture that time period that is unique. It's certainly a different type of war than we encounter in our current generation or may even in the future. And we actually have quite a few first-person accounts on our website, which I highly recommend. They have very meaningful descriptions of their times.
Your museum is on an active military post.
Right, that's very true. There is a way to get on post and be able to view the museum, depending on, of course, what's going on during that time.
Sure.
But we do have the ability to have them check in as visitors and come look. But they can get more information on that from the website as well.
So they'd want to definitely plan ahead and give a heads up ahead of time.
Yes. Certainly looking around at the different historic buildings also, because we're in the middle of the National Historic District for Schofield Barracks. And it's been preserved very much how 1941 would have looked at that time for the post.
Wow, so that's definitely worth going out of your way to go back in time.
I think so, certainly. You can put yourself in that place. Got all the old original trees and the roads and the buildings and the houses, just gorgeous.
Tell us a little bit more about your museum and the things that come to your mind that are the coolest things that you have that people can see.
One of my personal favorites is we have a handcrafted Viet Cong pistol that was modeled after a Soviet Czech Republic pistol. And what's so interesting about them is they didn't know much about the engineering of weapons. But what they could do is they could take apart a weapon and then they could copy that part in a very artistic way. They had to have this artistic eye to do it, and I think that's one of the things that I admire about it. Then they put it together and use it as a weapon, which of course you're kind of putting yourself into a 50-50 chance it's going to work or it's going to blow back at you, so you put your life in your hands when that happens. But it's a beautiful piece of craftsmanship and also ingenuity as to how they augmented their supply of weapons. And certainly the Viet Cong had a lot of different ingenuity in the way they defended themselves against what they considered us to be the enemy.
Give us another cool thing you'd see there.
Well, another really cool thing we have is from Wheeler. It's actually one of the original windows from the hangars that got shot at on December 7th. So it's got the original bullet holes from the Japanese Zeros. To me, that's amazing to see that these huge paned windows and these bullet holes that just strafed through. So we have preserved that. They just recently took them off, so we were able to capture one for the museum. The Smithsonian was given a pane as well.
And as I recall, the Pacific Aviation Museum, I saw on a Twitter feed the other day that they have in place, I think, some bullet holes in their hangars.
Absolutely. There's quite a few military posts on base. Hickam, certainly. Schofield saw some strafing, even though a lot of ours was wooden buildings, so a lot of those have demolished since then. But all around, you're going to see these concrete buildings that still have holes in them, and we've tried to preserve those so that they can be seen by people in the future.
I would imagine that because of time gone by and whatnot, one of the best ways to showcase that history would be from photographic displays.
Oh, definitely. Photographs are invaluable in being able to portray what it was like back then. Objects are important, but because we're talking about a lifestyle and we're talking about a place and an ambiance, a lot of times you can only get that from an image or a photograph. That's one of the things that people really come to us for are images. They want to see the barracks that their grandfather lived in or their father and the paths that they walked, the trees that they passed, and the chapel that they went to. So we have a lot of those, and we utilize them a lot in both museums, actually. And that's because you can look at it, and you get this feeling of nostalgia. You're there. You're seeing what kind of rough life they had. It's kind of reminds me of pioneering days, some of the pictures. They had it rough. You know, they didn't have the conveniences that even were available during that time in Honolulu.
Interesting. Well, let's come back to Waikiki and Fort DeRussy. In the Army Museum that is here today, open to the public, and I didn't even see a cost of admission when I walked.
That's right, we're free. Free admission, which we just think's wonderful because it gives people the opportunity to come in and learn more about what the Army's done in the Pacific and the important conflicts that it has taken a part in. Is really also a way for us to say thank you to our veterans for everything that they have done in the past and to showcase their brave ability to face things that we as a general public have been spared.
As I look over your shoulder, there are photos on the wall, and they look like pre-World War I.
Yes, and you can tell that they're all very serious.
This is like a Corps of Engineer construction battalion.
Yes, it looks like they've got their surveying equipment, and they're just posing for the camera right now, probably taking a break from all of their hard work.
Amazing, and all these young guys in the picture, and they're 120 today.
Oh, I know. It's so true. So very true. Very different lifestyle than what we see today, even in Waikiki. You don't really look around and see this Hawaii of 100 years ago.
You really have that palpable sense of Hawaii being a tropical island in the middle of the Pacific and not an urban center like it's become. Even though we know we can go 10 minutes and you think you're in Southeast Asia somewhere.
This is very true, yes. And that's the charm of Hawaii as well, that you get to have that juxtaposed of places to visit. Well, and certainly when you come into the museum at Fort DeRussy, you're transported back into that battery feeling. You don't feel like you're on an island any longer. You're in this very fortified building that has very thick construction.
Indestructible. Tell us a bit more about the Army Museum here at Fort DeRussy.
The Army Museum, we cover the history of the United States Army in Hawaii and in the Pacific. We start a little bit back further with the history of Hawaii and the military actions that unified the islands, the Western influences on the Hawaiians. We then go into the Army during World War I.
Let's backtrack a little bit. 1898, Spanish-American War.
Right.
And that was when America took possession of Hawaii. So I imagine there were some very strategic logistical centers of operations here.
Absolutely. The Army sent many surveyors, many generals to survey the area to see what could be done to protect the United States' interest in Hawaii. The Army determined that it was in the United States' best interest to fortify the island. We wanted to protect the island against foreign invasion, occupation. The Army decided to create Schofield Barracks. Then all the many, many, many installations on the island, including Fort DeRussy. The Army decided that Honolulu and Pearl Harbor was probably the most vulnerable. So that's why Battery Randolph was built, to protect Honolulu Harbor, Pearl Harbor, from the enemy, from enemy shipping, enemy warships.
Can you tell them a little bit about when they would do the practice shooting?
The guns were in place in 1914. The Army decided that we need to make sure these guns work. And the Army sent out warnings to the public that the guns were going to be fired. There were several houses on the beach directly below the gun battery. The commanding officer of the battery knew, he was positive, that there was going to be problems. The very first gun that was fired absolutely destroyed a poor young officer's house. Leveled the house.
Thankfully, he wasn't in it.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, he wasn't in there. But the house was just completely leveled. And that was a problem from the very first time it was fired until the guns were dismantled.
I heard stories about how people's china would rattle and fall off of the shelves all the way up to Manoa Valley.
Oh, wow. So this was an ongoing testing that they had to do.
Every year. There's annual testing of the guns. There were exercises throughout the year. And every single time, it was a ordeal for the Army to fire the weapons because of the warnings and the complaints and everything involved in warning the public. These guns are going off. Secure your house, secure everything the best you can. And a lot of times, it didn't make a difference. And that's one of the reasons why the guns weren't fired as much.
So even though this was a real primary defensive fortification,
right,
it wasn't a primary target for the Japanese sneak attack on December 7th, right?
Correct. It wasn't even on the Japanese radar. The Japanese aircraft carriers were off the northern coast, several hundred miles off the coast. The military at Fort DeRussy and Battery Randolph, they were on alert, but the guns weren't even fired.
Correct me if I'm wrong, Ian, but at the time when they built it, it was the first battery that had been built and fired for 14-inch guns. Is that right, for the technology of that? It was innovative for the time.
It was the biggest guns in the Pacific. That was how they were touted, that they were the biggest guns in the Pacific, the most modern facility, the epitome, the quintessential highest technology at the time.
I always find the construction very interesting.
The walls were made to protect the guns, the armor, the shells, the projectiles, and of course, the people inside. Facing the water, there was 30 feet of sand, 15 feet of steel-reinforced concrete wall.
Amazing.
It was amazing. Throughout the entire museum, different places are fortified differently. In the showroom, where the projectiles are armed, the fuses are installed, there's two ceilings. There's a 3-foot ceiling, reinforced solid concrete space, and then 15 feet of concrete.
Wow, amazing. Let's talk for a moment about cool things that people would see that come into the museum here at Fort DeRussy.
I think the coolest thing is the facility itself, hands down. You enter the museum, and it looks like a modern, contemporary museum. Then you enter, go through the great big black steel doors, and then you step back into time. You look down the hallway, and you see on the left how the battery was as it was built in 1913, 1914. You look around, and you see that all the rooms have bars on the windows. The bars were there to keep the people out, not keep people in, because when the battery was built, the hallway didn't exist. It was open to the outside, and all these rooms had... There were storerooms, they stored the projectiles, they stored the gunpowder. So those bars protected that. So to me, the coolest part is the building, because you step right back into the history of the building. It's amazing to me that a lot of the stuff is still here. I also like the fact that you go into what we call the showroom, and you can see how the shells, huge shells that these guns fired, were transported by overhead conveyor to a large concrete platform where the shells were armed. And we have mannequins to represent the soldiers that were arming or putting the fuses on the shells. Then the shells were lifted up through the roof and taken up to the gun deck. A person can look up and see the opening, how everything goes up to the shell room. Then there are speaking tubes throughout the building.
And they're still in place.
They're still in place. Unfortunately, not on display on the... one of our gun decks, we have a telephone box that was installed, you know, right at 1914.
Still there.
It's still there. So to me, the building itself is the most amazing thing.
Right behind you.
This just represents the artillery used in World War I. It's almost mint condition. We call this our cavalry room.
Now over here, this is really interesting. You have a black regiment. They were stationed here?
They were stationed up at Schofield Barracks, actually. That's the 25th Infantry Regiment, mm-hmm. Not to be confused with the 25th Infantry Division. They actually were at Schofield Barracks for only a short few years before they left for World War I, and they didn't come back.
So this is our showroom. The shells were transported by the overhead hoist, and they were put on the platform, and the soldiers would put the fuses on the shells. The shells would be lifted up on the conveyor, up through this area right here, this great big opening. It goes straight up to the roof. The room that we were in was where the gunpowder was packed, and it was also packed the same way that used on battleships. They would be inspected, put together, and then they'd also be lifted up through a smaller opening to the ceiling.
This really is a walk back in time, isn't it?
Yeah, the building's very much how it was. We've just added some exhibits, but we haven't really changed the integrity of the building that much.
Diamond Head was used as an observation post. So the folks at Diamond Head would determine where the enemy shipping was, and all that information was relayed to the gun battery. And then the commander of the gun battery would use the information from Diamond Head to fire.
So that was command and control?
Command and control, exactly. Yeah, this would be almost worthless without Diamond Head.
If somebody wanted to learn more...
For more information, you can go to our website. I recommend Googling Tropic Lightning Museum. We actually come up on the first page, and you can find those first-person accounts that I was talking about. We also carry them for Vietnam and also Korea, so you can read about more than just the World War II first-person accounts. We also have more information on our exhibits and our mission, if you'd like to look at that. And my name is Kathleen Ramsden, and I'm the museum curator. And I'm thrilled that you would come out to see us and to feature us on your podcast.
It's my pleasure and honor. Very cool.
My name is Ian Frazier. I'm the museum specialist and historian for Battery Randolph and Fort DeRussy. The museum is open Tuesday through Saturday from 9 a.m. to 4:15 p.m. We are closed federal holidays. We offer guided tours. We offer group tours. Our visitors can purchase audio tours, little handheld wands that they carry around the museum to explain to them about the museum. Both museums are free. We are located on the beach, U.S. Army Museum of Hawaii. You can't miss us. We have a great big sign on Kalia Road.
Thank you guys so much. What an honor to come here today.
Oh, thank you very much for coming. We appreciate having you.
My pleasure.
You've been listening to the Lowell Thomas Award-winning travel show Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer, a featured podcast on NPR.org's podcast directory. Produced by California Central Coast NPR affiliate KCBX. You are invited to subscribe to Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer on NPR.org, NPR One, iTunes, Stitcher.com, and more than 20 other podcast channels around the world.
My name is Roseanne Cash. I listen to WNYC in New York. And in fact, NPR is all I listen to. And if I didn't have NPR, I would feel like my lifeline to the world has been cut. So, yes, please support your local NPR station.
Funding for Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer is provided by Hawaiian Legacy Reforestation Initiative.
Hawaiian Legacy Hardwoods and Four Seasons Resort invite you to sponsor a legacy tree and contribute to the biodiversity of Hawaii. Legacy trees can honor an individual, commemorate an event, or memorialize a loved one. Every tree dedication is a living legacy and a gift which grows grander year after year. The best time to plant a tree was 20 years ago. The second best time is now.